I will call the meeting of the Historic Preservation Subcommittee to order. Today is January 26, 2022. And we don't have any sign postings. We don't have a consent agenda. Can we move to adopt today's agenda, please?
I propose that we adopt today's agenda. Darren Bagley Heath.
This is Robin. I second that.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes from last meeting?
I motion to approve the minutes as well for Darren. This is Darren Bagley.
And I will second that.
Great. Okay. Well, it looks like we can jump down to the regular agenda. Our first topic that we're revisiting is deconstruction. And I wanted to say that I knew I sent out a link to Google Drive, which had a few different resources in it, including some information from other communities, as well as an attempt to use other community ordinance as a baseline for a potential draft. And I'll say too, I don't know, Darren, if you got it, but Robin had found some additional documents as well.
I just saw that in the login, okay. Yeah.
And I'll say too, Robin, you know, he pulled San Antonio and they are really a leader like nationwide in this movement. I mean, you know, Portland's been up there as well, but they have all kinds of marketing materials. And if you look at even all of the other, they have a list of communities that they've consulted, which is pretty impressive. I could not quite figure out if San Antonio had adopted theirs within an ordinance, though.
It doesn't look like it. Here, let me go back to what I sent you. Hold on. Did I do that? I'm trying to remember which account I sent it from. Here, yes. It looks, they call it an initiative. So one thing I learned from the city is that ordinance is law, is a law that's basically legally binding. A policy is do it if you can, but it's non-binding. And I've not seen this term initiative, but it sounds sort of like policy. So it seems like ordinance is pretty universal as a term used across the country for these things. And the one of the last documents you uploaded, the Michigan State Center for Community and Economic Development, had the guide to local ordinances, and it assessed 7 different ordinances, including Portland and Milwaukee, as well as 5 that are not deconstruction ordinances. I forget what it's called. Hold on. It's called, God, I got all of them open as tabs here, so bear with me. C&D, construction and demolition ordinances. And so it seems like they didn't look at San Antonio in that report, but that report seemed to be a great tool for helping unpack these differences between the ordinances.
What I noticed as a layperson reviewing these, some of them appeared to be recycling and focused on property as a whole, whereas Milwaukee and Portland seem to address specifically historic properties and the deconstruction process. So one of my thoughts moving forward is that we have, even though I think recycling any demolition is a really important factor, is narrowing down any kind of initiative policy or whatever forward, we need to focus it on the historic element to kind of put that as the initial focus before the city may look further down the line and look at the rest of their demolition but kind of start it off with a smaller area of the community to focus upon, and obviously looking at recycling the materials being the emphasis.
Like a pilot.
Yeah, and I think if we in the remit of our commission as historic properties, I think that that's a good thing for them to get on board with and really kind of focus it, rather than looking at the bigger picture of recycling throughout the community in demolition. Just say, okay, we want to just really focus on these key points and draw that out. But also, I mean, there are valid points in the other policies that we can incorporate for sure. I just don't want us to bite off more than we can chew either.
Mm-hmm. Robin, you were saying that there was a document that was comparative, and you said CND, but I'm not sure which one that was. There.
So that was title? One of the ones you uploaded. It's called the
Guide to Local Ordinances.
Guide to Local Ordinances.
Yep, got it. Thanks.
Yeah.
And it's put together by the Michigan State Center for Community and Economic Development. Mm-hmm. And they did a really good sort of comparative analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And that coupled with the, I don't know if this is one of your, the deconstruction report that you had towards the bottom of your list, that assessed the efficacy of the Portland ordinance and talks about what percentage of a house was actually redirected. And, you know, so it gave some actual hard numbers of what was salvaged and mm-hmm. what went where. So I just wanted to follow up on Darren's comment. And when we're talking about recycling, do we mean salvage, where materials are taken out of a building and made available for reuse, as opposed to materials are taken out of a building and taken to a recycling center where they might be, I don't know, wood products might be ground up for mulch or.
And so, I think that's what we really have to drill down on. I mean, I think our focus, the way I see it anyway, at this point in time is salvage is the primary goal of what we're trying to achieve. And
then
anything after that is secondary, and that's what I don't want to get that lost in anything that we put together is our primary focus is salvaging materials that can be repurposed and reused in other historic properties to maintain historic relevance.
And my guess is, like, obviously thinking down the road here, but if we had three bidders on a term contract to do salvage, that might be one way where they might vary, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, what would they, and, you know, by making it too specific, by saying that something had to be resold or, you know.
But I think you put in the points process, and even in an application like that, you put in the points process that, yes, you want to be able to salvage as much as possible for repurposed use in other historic homes, but then you also give them points if they are also taking other parts of the deconstruction and recycling it as well. That would enhance their bid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, and I think the something that was an interesting graphic, but at least the document I look at as it translated into Google Docs, it got all a bit mangled, but there's a chart in the Missoula document, Demolition Alternatives Policy from Missoula, Montana, on the third page, it talks about deconstruction, demolition, recycling, and it lists companies. And so I think when you talk about bidders, I think part of this process might be figuring out what are the different companies, be it, say, the first one that comes to mind is Ramsey Callady's company, since he's been salvaging. And I know there are others, but that's the one I know best. Mm-hmm. And how many are there? Because it could be, if this ordinance goes to, as a proposal goes to council, and if we don't have a viable company, it's a well and good to propose an ordinance, but if there aren't people locally who can do it, which we know is not the case, we know we've got at least one company, and I'll defer to you guys if, Rebecca, I'm sure you know of others, and you know, where can things go? And Habitat for Humanity, what could they take versus, you know, would they what are the sort of the range of options we have? And so I think this kind of chart, I can't make out the part, the top row that shows what the criteria are is non-legible in my copy. So, but that's fine. We could come up with our own criteria. And so I think, you know, as long as we've got the companies, as think about this, if there's really just two cities that have a deconstruction ordinance per se, based on the study, the comparative study, and Milwaukee, Portland 2016, Milwaukee 2018, it's possible that Savannah could be the third city in the country.
Which is where we should be.
Which, yeah.
We should be on our vanguard.
I think, as you know, framing this for acceptance within, you know, different ways, you know, some people you emphasize the environmental dimension. Some, that one of the documents talk about the benefits in terms of job training. You know, there's so many aspects to doing this that I think could be integral to promoting the idea.
Well, and I wanted to kind of take a step back. I think this is a really good discussion, but the more that I looked into this, the more it seemed to me like this would be better suited as a standalone ordinance somewhere in the city code as opposed to housed under the historic ordinance, because I think there are other, I mean, it's applicable even outside of historic areas. So for it to be at the start placed somewhere else in the code would, I think, serve potentially to benefit for it to grow into a larger policy, even if it's just, even if the boundary is started in the downtown area. And that being said, you know, how does this group continue to either lead the charge or stay involved? I did call Nick Defley, who's the head of sustainability for the city, because, you know, as I was, like, for example, looking at Portland's, they talk about getting contractors like deconstruction certified and, you know, things that we don't, like, we don't have those programs. And, you know, even to Nick's point, we don't necessarily even have staff time already available for doing these kinds of things, but not to say that they couldn't all happen, right? So all this being said, should this be a larger initiative with a wider committee that might include people like the Office of Sustainability, someone from HDBR, code enforcement, building development services? Am I off base? What are your thoughts?
That's something that you have to create. You have to create a exploration to be able to do that and bring in other levels of expertise to grow it, for sure, because otherwise we can bandy around, but you have to bring those people in to discuss the possibilities of what a draft of an ordinance would even begin to look like.
Right.
I think before you reach, this is Pam Everett, before you reach out to anybody else, you need to involve Melanie Wilson.
Sure.
To ensure that, yeah, just to make sure she knows what's
going on. Thank you. Absolutely.
And I guess part of this exploration process would be if it was created under the umbrella of the historic preservation ordinance or whatever that's called that created us as a commission, would that in any way impact the creation of a larger ordinance down the road that would be citywide? So let's say first step as a kind of trial is we couch it within the preservation ordinance and essentially use that on a smaller scale to work out the kinks, and whether or not that would necessitate involving all those other parties, which it may, we still might have to involve all those other parties anyway, but it, mm-hmm. I think, Darren, you had mentioned maybe starting small and building. And so maybe
almost like a pilot program. And that's how I would see it, starting with out of this commission, and now the seed of this would be, we would launch it as a pilot program within the historic preservation districts, and then measure that, have a measurement of success, hopefully, that then you could spread the ordinance farther afield throughout the city and hopefully the county even.
Yeah. Just a point of clarification too. I was reaching out to Nick mostly to make sure that he was not already on some other path to do this also, you know. I don't want to duplicate efforts. So I did want to share that. And he it's on his radar, but there's no other initiative ongoing or anything like that. And to the idea of putting it in the historic ordinance and later growing it or moving it or whatever, I would say I'm a little bit pessimistic about, like, you know, these kinds of things. There's like a push, right? And then something gets done, and then
you
will
see,
anything
it's,
ever
it's on its laurels. So
will you, it ever evolve?
So you write it as a broader plan for the entire area, but you have it as a pilot program within the historic, and that's kind of what I envisaged it is it's seen as a citywide initiative, but the pilot program, the obvious place to start is within these boundaries, so we can measure the level of success over, you know, a 24 or 36 month process, and then review it after 3 years, and then go, was this successful? What are our metrics? And is this going to be applicable across the city or across the county to move forward as, you know, as a green initiative? Which again, Phil, you know, fits into other people's ideas of where we should be going anyway.
Hmm. Well, Bridget Liddy in the past has told me that with the city, it's common to the first step work with a policy rather than an ordinance. And that essentially could be that pilot program. And then, you know, use that experience to help shape the ordinance. So the problem with the policy is it's non-binding, right? It requires buy-in, and there's no regulatory teeth to force things to happen. So I don't know whether
say the community is doing its own pilot right now. I mean, there is a company, they can choose to call them, and, you know.
Right. But is then when you write it into the policy, how do you get people to buy in? Is there an incentive that they can be offered for buying in that makes it financially in? What do we financially incentivize a buy-in? Because that's the only way you're going to do it. And then if it's successful, then you say, okay, well, this is the policy. You may withdraw the financial incentive after the pilot program's in place, after the pilot program's closed, and you make it an ordinance. Or maybe there's a tax deduction that's applicable through historic preservation. No?
I'm not saying one couldn't be made, but that might be out of the scope of this. I mean, I don't know that we can create incentives for the, yeah, no.
Pam, correct me if I'm wrong, but that wouldn't be something we would do or be able to do out of here, right?
We could not. Incentives. No, create we couldn't.
Yeah.
But certainly
might be something that we recommend.
Right. Something an advocacy push, mm-hmm. you know, backed, recommended by this group.
Okay.
Well, I'm still in favor of having it be separate from the historic ordinance. And again, it can in a trial pilot, however you want to describe it, include just a small boundary to start, but then at least it's drafted, designed in a way that can easily grow and not have to be rewritten or.
And I think you're absolutely right in that aspect.
Because I don't, you know, having to ask for something twice from council, I think we would not want to, you know.
And you get change of administration and momentum, yes, as well over that period in time. So no, you have to have it so it has that. It's built in that the boundaries will expand. but you have the pilot program where it's either voted up or down based on the merits of the success of the pilot program.
So
yeah, I don't know if there are any, I'm just wondering, it might be worth checking with someone, and I don't know, Pam, if you know anything about ordinances and their the building of ordinances, but it seems to me that if you're going to get council to pass an ordinance, but implement it first via pilot program, I mean, does that even happen? I mean, to me, if you're going to pass an ordinance, it would go citywide, and that the pilot program would be something that would come before the passage of the ordinance. But I don't know, maybe they've got ordinances that are implemented in stages.
That's what we have to talk to the people who make those decisions and ask them those questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to hear, like, how do they approach a pilot? Like, how do they promote it? How do they run it? How do they get the word out? I mean, because I'm trying to think of, like, have there been other city initiatives where they've been pilots? I mean, I can't even think.
Well, the Portland ordinance, or at least one of the documents relating to Portland that you sent, did a really great job of in section one, it gave a timeline of how they got to where they were over a roughly 1 year period. The initiative actually came from city council in their city, but you know, directing the Bureau of Planning Sustainability to develop strategies, and then there was an advisory group, and then they established, you know, there are all these steps that they took, and I don't know to what extent any of those steps, or and maybe some of the other documents talk about steps that might help guide us in terms of how we approach this, but their advisory group, it says, met 16 times to provide advice on strategies and incentives for advancing deconstruction activities. So, and that deconstruction group included builders, developers, neighborhood groups, historic preservationists. So, you know, do we need to have a broader group that would be even for the pilot program?
So, this is, I guess, a question for legal people and staff and everything else. Would it be wise for us to invite downtown neighborhood association, Victorian Neighborhood Association, and a few members of council to a subcommittee meeting to gauge whether this is something that would have any buy-in anyway? And would...
not until you talk to Melanie, because she would be the person who would kind of...
She was just down here. Sorry, Pam, go ahead.
She would be the person who would decide whether or not the city would really want to be engaged in this, and she would approach the city manager to see who he would want to have involved. So we really would have to get her in the process. I mean, you guys are still talking about things, but before we invite anybody else into these subcommittee meetings, we need to have her involved.
Pam, she was just down.
She can't be blindsided.
She was just down here. Do you want me to see if she has a couple minutes?
I'm sorry, I can hear her on a phone call.
Melanie was just down here. Do you want me to see if she has a couple minutes?
No, what I'm telling you is I hear her in her office talking.
Oh, she's on the phone call. Gotcha.
Yeah, she's on the phone.
I think at a minimum, you know, if we don't get the opportunity to talk to her in the next couple minutes, that we reach out, and that being like the next step. But
I was going to ask you to write an email.
Sure.
With those bullets that you want answers for, or guidance on, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
can we move on to the next item again?
Yeah. Are there any final thoughts before we jump?
I think we're at an impasse where we need to discuss, and I feel that we're going to end up with a couple of these things with the other items as well, so we might as well talk about them and then wrap them up and then go, okay, this is what we need to do
to move
forward.
Yeah, so if we If we do move on to number three, which is the legacy homeowner ordinance provision, I will say that that's probably the item I've done the least on thus far, as far as, you know, I did, I put out a query to two kind of nationwide chats. One is the Historic Preservation Professionals Group on Facebook, which is very active and good.
I think I actually saw your post.
Okay.
I followed the thread.
And then there's also a more formal one that the National Trust nonprofit has called Forum Connect that is an email listserv, and I didn't get much response out of that one. What was recommended to me on that Facebook group were all communities that had some leniency or provisions for compromise in their ordinance, local district provisions for, it was mostly for low income related properties, but none of them were ordinances. They were, again, were all policy recommendations, kind of like the way we operate, right? Like that, you know, whether the town was small enough or the community was, you know, amenable to them working in a fashion of less legality. You know, that, and I think I sent you West Palm Beach, which had like a spreadsheet of almost like a flow chart.
Yeah.
Which is good, but I mean, you guys can tell me what you think, but I strongly think that it has got to, again, be an ordinance in order for Savannah to be on board and work.
My issue with it, after looking at some of the material and sitting on it for a period, is it's so open to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That where somebody gets some work done and then it gets transferred, and well, this is the way it was, but there's all these elements. Well, it's the wrong shingles, but I bought it this way, so therefore why can't I continue it this way? Why am I being told I have to do something that's going to cost me tens of thousands of dollars more to replace what's existing because it was changed 2 years before I bought it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
bring it back into line because I want to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, it's really going to have to be analyzed, right? And I don't want to say ironclad, because, like, I mean, you can punch a hole in anything, but
especially with low-income housing and people taking them over and improving them around what's already being done. If that person passes away and the family sells it, and I feel that there could be a lot of bumps that would create a lot of hassle for staff more than anything else, because you're buying something and, well, I was allowed to put these windows in, but now I'm doing this, I can't put the same windows in on the back and it doesn't match, and now I'm gonna have to change all the windows. Or
yeah, why is it different today than it was yesterday?
These were only installed 2 years ago, why can't I put the matching windows in, or the door, or whatever it is? Yeah,
well, and in that same way, yeah,
okay.
Well, and I don't, you know, it's kind of an odd comment, but.
Or even doing it prior to the sale. The other thing I see as well is some less than ethical folks making arrangements with a existing owner to make repairs prior to the sale of to transfer mm-hmm. the property, and then transferring the property almost immediately after the work is concluded.
Yeah.
And having the work done on the cheap, and yet being able to maximize the profit out of the house.
Well, and we could have another bullet point about enforcement, but but what I was going to say was, you know, kind of similar to what I'm learning about these other communities, right, too. It can almost be like, maybe that's just how this HPC operates, you know, that we are taking into consideration, because, you know, it our word, how we choose to approve.
So a provision rather than an ordinance.
I mean, I'm not saying this is my preference. I'm just kind of like talking through this, right?
And where it's at the discretion of us to, where it comes through, and understand that it's a legacy home rather than an improvement by somebody who's just bought the house, or somebody who's looking at it as an investment property.
Right now, and this question for Leah, like, it would be inappropriate for us to ask an applicant, how long have you lived in this house? I mean, I feel like we do that.
And we could look at it even through tax records.
Yeah. Could they ask something like that, Pam?
If we were doing this type of ordinance?
Well, no, in like current fashion.
Right. Let's just say, like they were just saying that if they didn't change the ordinance, but based some of their decisions on whether or not this person has been there for a long time, can they ask questions like, how long have you owned this property or lived here, or you know, things like that?
We probably should not. I mean, we've asked owners how long they've owned buildings. I know when we're looking at demolition and things like that to make sure that they didn't just buy it just to demolish it.
I feel like I've sat in ZBA meetings where that was asked. Like,
sometimes they have asked.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, they have. Well, like if somebody's trying to change something on their home, they have.
A follow-up that I have to that is, if they were applying for a special exception, they probably could, because of the criteria for a special exception.
Right.
Okay.
So but it's just a regular, you know, we're trying to make something, some change. I don't think we should.
So for instance,
I don't want people to say that we're discriminating based upon how long they've owned their home.
Or that sorry, but we play a scenario out. Somebody in the Victorian district has owned their or in Carver has owned their home for 45 years, and there's significant issues with the property as far as they need to. There's some windows that are rotted out and they absolutely have to be replaced, and they can't replace, they can't afford to put in the wood replacement windows, and therefore say vinyl windows was the only affordable option for this fixed income person. We could look at that and say, well, you've lived in that neighborhood for 45 years, and we could approve it on a, you know, on a special
exception
because the house otherwise is going to continue to deteriorate, or this person is going to be displaced because it's not going to be fit living conditions. And we could do that under the current.
So hang on a second. And I wonder, as I'm looking this up, let me look up the exact language for a special exception.
Yes, please.
Because if that is in fact the fact that we don't need
And I'm just sitting here thinking too, like, is the special exceptions under the historic ordinance? If so, can we edit it?
Well, that
can we add to it?
That's what I was just gonna look and suggest and see what it says. So special exceptions only apply to, well, here, let me look it up.
Sure.
Just be easier if you all look at the language.
You still there, Robin?
Yep, I'm still here. I was gonna say, can we take economic standing into account? Because I know on the HDBR, economics aren't supposed to affect our decision making.
So let's look at this first, and then we can talk about it a little bit. So special exceptions, the purpose is to provide relief from specific standards within the ordinance. It's not the intent to eliminate standards, but rather to provide a process by which exceptions can be made for individual circumstances. And then it lists the sections that you can grant special exceptions to, which basically covers, you know, anything you all would have purview over. So here are the two criteria. Mm-hmm. So whether the use for which the special exception is being considered will be located, operated, and maintained in a manner in conformance with goals, policies, objectives of the comp plan and provisions of the ordinance. Whether a special exception would not be detrimental to the public health interest, safety, welfare, function, and appearance of the adjacent uses or general vicinity. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Pam, but that's, I wouldn't say vague, but subjective.
I would say it falls within the comprehensive plan because neighborhoods together is part of that comprehensive plan and an inclusive community. So I would say that in that vagueness of it, it allows a very broad interpretation of the ordinance and would allow us to do that.
I mean, you all have seen the recent comp plan, and that you know, we added the whole affordable housing component and preservation and, you know, all those sorts of things. And obviously also, if it wasn't detrimental to the public health, you know, public health, safety, welfare, whatnot, you know, then that could.
But when it is in the interest of public health and safety and welfare, then again, you can apply special exemptions. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I could probably name like five different goals of the comp plan that, you know, would speak to it. So, yeah. And we could, you know, as part of this group, for example, kind of pick out some of those goals from the comp plan to have at our ready, you know. I'm not 100% convinced, you know, that this, do we not need to do something more substantial, formal, because it's not always going to be us sitting
What is that? I mean, it may actually be easier for us to put that in, I guess, or ask for approval with that and slide it into the Historic Preservation Commission our policies. I can see that would be easier to write than actually the first one we reviewed, because we've already got the criteria.
Yeah, I mean, the HQ. Sorry.
Oh, no, don't worry about it.
The HPC could, you know, propose a text amendment to the MPC, correct, Pam? That would add maybe a third criterion, whatever that might be, you know, in relation to, you know, legacy homeowner, and then define that or something.
What does a legacy homeower entail?
Right. Yeah. To define that.
And also and then, the hardship exemptions that allow you to do it.
They could, and then you mean, and you mean changing the ordinance as well?
Correct, changing this section of the ordinance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or a special could exception.
Make a could make a recommendation.
If we did that, could HDBR also use it?
Yeah. Yeah, this applies to both HDBR and HPC.
Okay, well, let's, team, let's think about the wording, maybe spend some time. You know, if you can just open the comp plan again and then think about what might C say. There's A and B. We want, right? Are we in it? Are we on board for that? Or
what does legacy? What do we mean by legacy?
Mm-hmm.
And what constitutes a hardship as well? Because you may have somebody who's living in a home and the cost of repairs, even though they have, you know, an average American income, still not be able to afford to make the repairs because the cost of the repairs still exceeds their household budget and makes it financially implausible for them. So you've got to have a little bit of wiggle room. It can't just be some little old lady who was widowed 20 years ago and is living on a, you know, on Social Security. There's got to be a little bit more play in it than that to appeal to allow the average working Savannian to be able to afford some stuff as well without crossing the line too far. No, it's really
well, that's why I'm like, let's take the month, right? And
yeah.
There is a section, and if you all want to check out this section too, the actual variances section, because they're more specific about burden of proof and financial hardships and things of that nature.
Okay.
So you could potentially even say like C section blah, blah, blah for definition of hardship or, you know, okay, something like that. If there is something like that in there, I'm just trying to look here. Let's see. Because there's a link to the criteria here somewhere.
Why don't you control F the word hardship?
Why what? I'm sorry.
Control F the word hardship.
Oh, right. But I was going to pull up the criteria. There you go. Usual circumstances, the strict application of the design standards would result in exceptional practical difficulty or undue hardship. Which I wonder if that's defined.
I was going to say, is there a definition?
Yeah, so let's see. Let's look under definitions. But yeah, I mean, here's the criteria for an actual variance. So you could potentially sort of grab some of that language for a new special exception criterion.
But when there is
go ahead.
Sorry. When there is a special exception, that is a variance then.
Well, it's not, because you all aren't a judicial or quasi-judicial board, and that's why it's called a special exception and not a variance. But it's, for all intents and purposes, it's the same thing. You're granting a waiver to something within the zoning ordinance. That's why it's called a special exception instead of variance.
Says there is, under section 3 in special conditions, that it's not to be used for somebody to be able to gain, have, get financial gain out of the variance or the approval.
Right.
Go down on the special conditions.
Oh, sorry.
Right here. No, back up. 3. There we go.
Thank
special
you.
Conditions and all circumstances that are purely financial in nature, so as to allow the applicant to use the land, building, or structure more profitably. Profitability. Big money. So.
Yeah, and if hardship is not defined, again, you could always define it. I'd be interested to see, just because I, you know, these used to be the criteria for which you all made a recommendation to the Zoning Board of Appeals, but they weren't your criteria to make a decision based on. But Pam, I would think that the ZBA uses that language and defines it somehow if they're, you know, granting a variance with in regard to it. Let's see, abbreviations and definitions. Economic hardship, the denial of all reasonable use or return on a piece of property by the application of regulation.
Broad. But that's good that at least there is a definition.
Yeah. And of course, definitions can be tweaked too. But I mean, I think that's pretty thorough for what we're talking about here. Especially, you know, stating economic hardship. But I wonder if, yeah, okay. Sorry, I was just thinking out loud. But.
Well, I think that's set us on a path. And I think it makes sense. You know, I think, again, it'll be a test of however we do it. Is it effective? And I was also thinking too that if we go this route and it is more of a, you know, yes, we're adding some language, but it's more of an understanding about how to use the language as part of our discourse and our decision making as part of this group, that, you know, something that could accompany it, and whether it's done by staff or whatever, is, you know, just like a document or a pamphlet or something that's user friendly. Again, to talk about the importance of primary facades over secondary facades, and, you know, the hierarchy, and, you know, yes, there are middle of the road options sometimes that are better than vinyl, you know, like, yes, wood composite windows, or, you know, just explaining some of those things might be another way that we can reach out to the community too.
And I think you're right that we need to have this in place, because, as you said, we're not going to be hit as a planning commission in 3 years. It's going to be established, but there's going to be a bunch of us that aren't going to be here going forward to make those decisions. And we need to kind of put a precedent in place at the beginning that the interpretation's there, but also what the limits of that interpretation is on this wording.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good.
Okay. So a little bit of homework. There. We'll look at the comp plan, think about language, think about definitions, and discuss again.
mpc.plan2040.org.
And then that's the, in an email.
Yep. And then it's the quality of life section. Wait, here we go. Oh, Savannah Chatham, element Chatham, excuse me, and then quality of life.
The next item on our agenda is the ordinance for exterior building materials. And I had said in my email that I was still gathering material, but I did do that. And I started a folder in the Google Drive. specifically with information about stucco and some of it's from like a national stucco association. My tablet just died, so I don't have it in front of me now, but there's good material about the different types of stucco, the different ways it's applied, and what types of stucco are best in humid climates, wet climates. And I even found that same group, this stucco organization, has a map of the country, and we are in the, you know, they include Savannah in the most humid and moist areas of the country, right? So like we're in there with Florida and you know, Alabama, Southern Alabama and all of that. But I will just, I've got some like brief points, but if we can maybe all agree to just look at what's in that folder. But I'm just gonna just share these few thoughts. So obviously stucco is cement, water, and sand. You know, historic stucco is with lime, but now it is cement. Traditional stucco is a three-coat process, a scratch coat with a brown coat and a finish coat. There's also something as a two-coat stucco, which that is the stucco over masonry. And there's no longer a need for a scratch coat if you do that. And it utilizes a bonding adhesive. But that two-coat system the stucco organization says it provides extreme water resistance with no need for a water-resistant barrier. And a water-resistant barrier is typically used when it's stucco over studs. So you think about that traditional stucco, the three-coat process. That is what is required when you have stucco over wood framing. So there's this like membrane, right, that's supposed to get the water out from behind the stucco itself, because they're basically saying some water is going to get in, and that is the difference between stucco over wood versus stucco over masonry. And what I read, the masonry, you know, stucco over masonry is much better for humid climate. So this is like basically, you know, this was like our hypothesis, at least, you know, when I started to think about this and we were discussing it and how we don't have a definition for true stucco, which is, I guess, how it's described. I see you pulled it up, Leah. Thank you. I see. Okay, so currently we're allowing the two or three coat.
The two coat is what we're saying is not sustainable for the environment within which we live, because it's built with a failure rate that's going to be coming sooner rather than with a three part coating over masonry.
I mean, that is my interpretation of what I've pulled so far.
Do they even suggest anything on that site that as far as failure of stucco over a lifespan in a humid environment?
I mean, it seems to me they're recommending the stucco over masonry, which, you know, more often than not would be, in, especially in new construction, a CMU, concrete blocks.
No, of course it wouldn't. It's not financially viable.
No. But it was interesting also just some of the other things that, you know, was reading, and just to point out, right, so there is another option, but we don't allow it, which is this, the EFIS, the synthetic stucco mixed with fiberglass. So, and I think that's like the worst of the worst. And you see that around town, right, in areas that aren't historic, that are just have lots of staining. And but also what they said too is, you know, stucco, they were saying stucco has, you know, more variables than any other assembly, right? Like there's so many factors that go into like what is making stucco successful. So what I would like to propose is, if you all will, it's not a lot, it's certainly less pages to review than, like, for example, compared to the deconstruction file. So, but if you don't mind to look at what I've pulled, I just want to, because this, I'm not a contractor, and I know, you know, none of us are, but it would just be helpful to have other eyes on this and see if you are deducing the same information that I did.
Rebecca, I'm at the Google Drive. I don't see the folder. I see all the...
I'll pull it up on here.
Yeah, I just see all the deconstruction documents, but I don't see anything related to Stucco.
I probably have to make it available to you. It is in there, but probably only I can see it. So I will do that. Any other thoughts about weathering building materials, Stucco?
Would it be worth getting feedback from, well, I don't know, groups that have used, be it preservation firms, Coastal Heritage Society, contractors, whomever, who have experience working with stucco in Savannah? Would it be worth getting some insight from those people?
Let me just ask Pam a question real quick. Pam, can we legally create like a technical advisory committee made up of some people like that?
No.
Okay.
No. We can talk to Melanie about how to go about it and dealing with it through the MPC, but to just do it on our own, no, we can't.
I think the issue is not with people who put it up, it's the people who repair it and maintain it that you want the information from. That's where the, you know, what are the, when folks going in to do renovations and repairs on pre-existing buildings with stucco, what are the issues that they're finding and having to tackle 10, 20, 30 years after initial construction? And what does that look like? And what is the damage that has been incurred that you can't see that they're having to address as well?
I will say just anecdotally, I was talking to an architect about this and, it was like not all stucco's made the same. And I feel like maybe I'm even just kind of, no pun intended, scratching the surface at, you know, the other components that are influencing why we're seeing so much weathering. You know, maybe it isn't just install, maybe it's also like manufacturer and, you know, things that we may or may not have any purview over. But just as an aside, so the architect was sharing that as an example of one stucco install that has been successful and has weathered well is the, I think it's the Synovus Bank building, which is like the northwest corner of Johnson Square, so just south of City Hall. So next time you're driving by, check that out. Where I left it was like, oh, well, can you send me the spec for that? Because, you know, what is different about that? So I intend to follow up about that. But there might be even more research that, you know, is we can do. But for homework for this meeting, if we can, I will make the folder available and we can chew on what I've compiled. And committee, if you find anything else you'd like to drop in the folder, please feel free to do so. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So dropping in the folder, let me just go to that. So if I wanted to, so you just drag and drop, is that the method that you add things there?
It should work.
Okay, I can try that, make sure that works.
If for some reason it doesn't, you can email to Leah and she will send it out to all of us.
All right, next. Where are the examples within the purview of our committee where stucco has been an issue? I'm trying to remember, like I could see downtown stucco being a bigger issue, but I'm trying to remember incidents.
South of Bull Street. I think they were more new construction, but they were going in there and it was compatibility. I think it was a Shea contract.
That's an issue of
so it's where... new and then it's comparing it to to other existing structures we were looking at.
Right.
I think it was a development south of the park.
Yeah, no, I remember where we denied or tabled his application because it was 2/3 or 3/4 stucco above the first floor, and none of the buildings, including the ones he used as his own comparables, had stucco. They were all brick all the way up. But to me, that's an issue of, and I'm not sure what kind of stucco panels they were, but they had control joints. So they're not, it's not even traditional stucco. It's just, so is that EIFS if it has the control joints or?
No, not necessarily.
No, I mean, we're very careful. Staff's very careful to make sure it's not EIFS, which is basically like a sprayed on one coat. It's not even plaster onto a basically an insulation panel. That's what's right. Not permitted.
Right.
This was more like a more like what we see these days, which is a couple of coats stucco on like a sheathing, and then that's over studs.
But they have these control joints, which suggests that they're just installing these stucco panels.
The control joints are honestly a learned, you know, method to keep stucco from cracking over the years. So now it's required by code that you put these in to keep it from cracking, whereas they didn't do that historically, and that's why stucco cracks. Not saying that it doesn't crack with this, but supposedly the idea is if it cracks along the control joints instead of up the middle, that's the purpose of control joints.
Okay.
I'm not saying that they're attractive because they are not, but that does not mean they're assembled in panels. They're actually still, yeah, just to kind of explain what those are for. Yep.
So in the case with the Shea proposal, are we looking to limit the amount of stucco used in proposals, especially in the district south of the downtown district? There's a relatively limited amount of stucco on buildings, and some districts probably have virtually none, which is a different issue from figuring out how stucco performs and is repaired. So I'm just wondering, what is the motive here with regard to stucco?
Well, because it's become a popular cheap, higher added value way of building large scale projects to fit the density in housing, I would say. So if we allow that to open the door, and then all of a sudden you've got another apartment building and another apartment building that all kind of conform to this formula, then that becomes the norm in that district.
Right. So that's a different issue to me than which stucco performs best.
The thing is, Robin, as we've established, is that the one form of stucco over masonry would probably be the preferred one because it's the one that's suitable for this climate. And
right.
The second one, which is probably not suitable for this climate, is you can do it over studs and over wood, and it is the preferable form of construction because it is the lower cost.
Right.
So nobody's going to go and put stucco over masonry because the masonry is attractive in the first place, and you're just adding cost to the build. So it makes it financially not viable to
right.
build the stucco.
If
the origin of what we're doing is what rooted in the weathering of historic buildings and the quick aging that right. we're seeing, right, and that is detrimental to the integrity of our district because our buildings are becoming weathered extremely fast.
So it's the ones that are two coats over some kind of panel that's installed on a building are weathering worse than the two-part stucco on top of masonry.
I mean, that's what I'm reading, right? I don't have the specs for every build, right? This is where it would be great to have a technical committee, and we could say, oh, let's look at this building and how was it installed. But I just don't, it's very hard to have that data. But I do feel like I have gone to a strong source and pulled some good info, and I'm totally willing to digest more. And I would love to see things even more specific to Georgia, for example, or, you know, because obviously we'd be getting more to the heart of this. But and then I did want to speak. So you were asking about the applicability for our districts that we regulate. And, you know, I think the truth of the matter is that there has been an uptick in new construction applications for our area included with four stucco buildings. So that is important, whether or not it is character defining feature of the historic buildings in those areas or not. And then also, I think our edit of the true masonry definition would be applicable also to the downtown area. And again, kind of like our other initiatives, we're going to be benefiting an even wider area by doing this, which we all would, you know, yes, all of the photos I pulled into that album, which I added one today, by the way, are indeed, well, except for one, are of the downtown area. And that was just honestly by nature of when I happened to be available to take a photo, you know, it was, but there are more stucco buildings downtown, so.
I'm looking at one.
Is that folder also in the Google Drive?
It was in the email. It's a,
oh, the email. It's okay.
A Google Photos folder, but I could fold the photos out and put them in the drive. I will just re-invite you directly to it. And
okay. Well, I can see stucco now.
Okay, great. Okay, what else, team? New business, old business?
Well, just one more thought about stucco. Would mm-hmm. be part of what we are considering, I mean, with the issue of compatibility, that certainly is a tool we can use for the Historic Preservation Commission in the districts that we're in. You know, we could leverage that standard, and it certainly worked when we were reviewing the proposal from Pat Shea. And you know, if there are within one of our districts an area, say along Bull Street or I don't know, some place where yes, there are existing stucco buildings and stucco is at least not incompatible, but in many districts or parts of our purview, I mean, we've already got a tool that we can use, that we can leverage. So I guess the goal would be to figure out when stucco is being used, if I understand the issue, when it's a compatible material, what's the best form of stucco that should be used?
Right. And just acknowledging that we reference true stucco in the ordinance, but it is not defined. Oh, it is?
It is, but I think it's frankly worded poorly. See right here, also referred to as true stucco. I think here it should say true stucco, personally.
So wait a minute, stay here for a second.
Yeah, okay. I'm just gonna highlight the whole thing.
I mean, the way that I read this is it has to be over masonry. We're just not upholding that.
Exterior plaster applied as a 2 or 3 part coating directly over masonry. Historic stucco consisted primarily of hydrated or slaked lime water sand, also referred to as true stucco. Yeah?
So maybe...
Is that how you read that, PM? I just want to check. Because I almost think it should be amended to say true stucco at the beginning.
Well, and actually the way I'm reading this too is it's saying true stucco is the lime, which is, you know, yes, that's the traditional stucco.
Yeah, well, that's a whole different sentence because then that says right. Historic stucco.
But maybe to be, so if I understand this according to this definition, and this is in the City of Savannah Code of Ordinances. So this regulates both the HDBR and the HPC, is that correct?
Yeah, this regulates the entire zoning ordinance. These are abbreviations and descriptions for the entire city of Savannah ordinance.
So in theory, this definition of stucco should prohibit, now EFS is explicitly prohibited, but what about those two coat, what Pat Shea was proposing on his building wasn't over masonry.
Right, I mean, we're just looking at this definition now and wondering if this means it can only be over masonry per this definition.
It hasn't been enforced correctly, but possibly.
Yeah, I mean, Pam, that's how it reads, correct?
Sorry, it is how it reads.
Applied directly to, well, I think the way you, when you read in it, exterior plaster applied as a two or three part, I think when they were written, it was written wrong, but the way it reads, yes, it does read as it applies directly onto masonry.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think the intent when it was written was the two part was you could put it on it and then the three on masonry.
Yep.
But I think that, yes, it ties it up that as it's written, you can't use it over.
Yep.
Over wood.
I don't necessarily think it's, I don't think that historic stucco sentence belongs in that spot.
Pat, stucco, modern stucco uses cement rather than lime, correct, as a binding agent?
Portland cement, correct.
Portland cement?
Yep.
So I think that even that, I mean, one could, I don't know if, if we're cleaning up this definition, I mean, also, I think it would be worthwhile getting explicit about what is the binding agent, under what circumstances, if any, do you require lime, or is Portland cement appropriate under all circumstances, which we know it isn't, but, you know, I think, but even with the current wording, we could base, if we wanted to, as an HPC, we could look at a proposal that has stucco panels that aren't over masonry and just say, sorry, this is not conforming to the ordinance, and start,
yep,
and start imposing this standard that hasn't been imposed.
Yep.
I think that's great. I think we've solved the problem.
Problem solved.
By accident.
Well, do you guys still mind doing the homework?
No, you still do the homework for an exercise, but I think that,
I mean, I am genuinely curious about this, right? I also don't know if you know, I think my point earlier about all the different facets of this speaks to this, right, is that maybe this isn't the only answer or the only thing that's influencing how these buildings weather. So, and you will see that even in my photo compilation, there are photos in there that are not stucco, but I wanted to include them because it's really a wider problem. And just Savannah is wet, and
it's only going to increasingly get more wet and more humid.
And you know, got white bricks in your white stone, you know, just looks awful.
Well, you know, I have the example of the Houses of Parliament has been the other one. They just get black and gross every 25, 30 years and they have to pressure clean it. So it's either maintenance in one way.
Well, yeah, and I think that's, I've thought of that too, is about, like, again, enforcement, but also like just better minimum maintenance standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you have is maintenance something, unless it's a threat to the public safety, can you require people to clean the soot or the dirt or the mold off their building?
Right.
I think we would have to look in the international code that Code Compliance uses for property maintenance definitions.
Yeah. What deferred maintenance?
I was going to say, I feel like I know communities that do, but
yeah, yeah. I mean, based on what they're doing now, because that's what Code Compliance is using as their basis based on the conversation meeting that we had with them a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is that international? I forget what it's called. My apologies, but the name of
yeah.
the sort of general property maintenance code that's not in the zoning ordinance.
Okay. Well, at this juncture, I think I will call for final thoughts. Anything we haven't discussed that you want to bring up?
I would just recommend you all reading this one in depth too, because I think it would define a lot of the things we're talking about, but it also does have stucco mixes in it as they proceeded through the years.
We dropped that in that Google Drive as well onto that folder.
Yeah, I have it already on my desktop. Okay. So,
so, you know, soft brick mortar, traditional, there's that word again, mm-hmm. you know, early 20th century, American Portland. So, you know, since 1929.
And I, you know, I hadn't dropped it in there yet because I just, this is so new construction based.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, it's good to have this as a primer, but there's a lot of information here that may not directly pertain to.
It does, but I think that it kind of relates to our definition of it and how we may need to
right
to pull tweak out
that historic definition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I mean, even if you go back to what do we have here, like soft brick and soft stucco, there was already look at that non-staining Portland cement.
Where do we buy that?
Yeah, 1 quart white non-staining Portland cement.
That sounds like good branding.
So, I mean, you can go back pretty far in history where they already started using Portland cement in their stucco. It's just not solely Portland cement like it is now.
Mm.
That's kind of the point I was making.
New Orleans as well. So that actually works with the environment as well. So that's actually specific to a subtropical environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought it just might be helpful for a lot of terminology and composition and stucco mixtures and things like that, and even definitions about traditional stucco and, you know, that kind of stuff. Because I don't think we should be requiring horsehair and and hydraulic lime for, you know, new construction. So.
And even if we pull out that true stucco definition, I guess it's good to have it on the historic rehab side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. You all should discuss when you're going to do your next one or, you know, that you're not going to do your next one or whatever you want to do.
The next meeting?
Yeah.
We want to meet at the same time before the next HPC meeting.
Want to do next month or do you want to do it? Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, that sounds fine. Is it the end of February?
February 23rd is your next meeting. Is the next February 23rd the next HPC meeting?
Okay. Let me just.
We will meet again at 1 p.m. on February 23rd. The motion to adjourn.
I make a motion that we adjourn. This is Robin.
I second that motion.
Thanks, everyone. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Rebecca, for all your leadership on that.